There was a moment last year where I caught myself wondering, am I an addict? Not to drugs, not to alcohol, to social media. Maybe addict is too strong a word, but I'd hit a point where Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, they weren't bringing me joy anymore. So I quit, and honestly, I haven't looked back. But for a lot of people, it's not that simple, especially if you're hooked young. Last week, a woman successfully sued Meta and YouTube, arguing their platforms were addictive. She said she was spending up to 16 hours a day online, starting from just 6 years old, and she's been awarded $6 million in damages, although the companies are appealing. The case raises some big questions, like, is social media addiction actually real? Can you walk into a psychologist's office and get diagnosed and be treated for it? Or are we using the language of addiction a little too loosely here? We do throw that word around a lot, but I'd love to know from you, would you say you're addicted to social media or that someone in your life is? Have you been able to kick that habit? Here with me is Dr. Dion Tullett-Prado, a provisional psychologist whose PhD looked into this murky line between problematic social media use and addiction. Dion, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Tegan. It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
So social media as an addiction, is there any consensus around whether that's a fair diagnosis?
I want to say so, no. Unfortunately, it's as much of a debate in the academic community as it is amongst the lay people, I suppose.
But it's something that you've looked into for your research. Where did you land, at least in your own mind?
I certainly landed more along the lines of it is an addiction. And there's a number of reasons for that. It has the same kind of characteristics in terms of what it kind of provokes in people, the kind of fixation, the loss of control, the inability to stop, which is certainly something that I think is familiar to most of us. If you've ever been scrolling reels and time has just seemed to rapidly shift forward and you look at the clock and it's 2 hours later, you know, you've experienced something that a lot of addicts do when, you know, using maybe something more obviously addictive, like a substance or stuff that we've classified as a behavioral addiction already, like gambling addiction. So we certainly see that kind of similarity. We see similar areas of the brain light up, for example. We see similar behaviors and symptoms. And we certainly see, I guess, the characteristics of an addictive substance in social media, which is to say that, you know, why do we get addicted to things? Why do we get addicted to, like, you know, gambling or sugar, for example? It's because it's something that we really kind of need in this vital way. We have this biological evolved need. It's something that we've developed over, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, right? This is Stone Age firmware that we've brought into the present. Mm. And in the Stone Age, you know, let's say sugar, you know, we need sugar desperately to survive. We want it. And it's really, really hard to get. We have to go and kill something and it might kill us or it might get away. We might expend a ton of calories trying to catch it and it gets away. So it's actually really dangerous trying to go get that thing. And even if we do get it, there's actually not that much sugar in it. We're not going to, you know, take that much from it. And so the brain's really got to reward you for doing this thing to make sure that you keep doing it because it's vital to your survival and it's really, really important. And so it becomes this reward. It becomes something the brain rewards. And that's really healthy. That's really healthy in the Stone Age environment. But then come to the present. What do we have in the present? We have abundance. You know, we can make sugar, you know, with a click of a finger, right? This factory is pumping out so much sugar right now, you know, your Stone Age brain can't possibly comprehend it. We you know, get a packet of Mars bars or something like that. We ingest it and we're having more sugar than, you know, that Stone Age brain was ever adapted to. And it doesn't understand that it's no longer hard to get because your firmware doesn't change with time, at least not that quickly. It takes a long time. And so we're still catching up biologically to this radically different environment, this environmental mismatch that we're in. And so we still crave sugar as much as we did before, but it's all around us. It's easy to get, so we just take it in. And when you look at social media, it's essentially the exact same. We have a craving for social contact, for social applause, for social status. This is extremely necessary. If, you know, we are a small tribal group of monkeys, which is kind of what we've evolved for, tribal living. And if the tribe doesn't like you, you're dead. If they cast you out 20,000 years ago in the Stone Age, you're dead. And so we desperately want this and care for it. And we constantly seek out the love and connection of others and the applause of others. We want social status because that means access to food and mates and so on. And this is what the brain is after. And then social media gives you this instant gratification way to get that, this extremely easy way to access other people, receive applause by other people and so on. But it does so in a very kind of simulacra way, which is essentially the same as like, you know, cheap sugar and gambling and so on. So when you look at social media, it has the kind of characteristics of something that we would guess is, you know, addictive. There's some complicating factors, certainly. And there's also concerns about, you know, pathologizing all behaviors also, certainly. But I would argue that the evidence outweighs the kind of contrary, that social media is an addictive substance.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Dion Tullett-Prado, a provisional psychologist whose PhD is on the concept of social media addiction. We're talking about this today because of a recent case, a case last week in the US, where a woman was awarded $6 million in damages from the owners of YouTube and Instagram, the parent companies of those sites, because they were found to have created an addictive platform. On the text line, someone says, the social media issue with the woman in the States, what were the parents doing giving a six-year-old a phone to use 24/7? It's their fault. That actually was covered in the case, and I think goes to the point of vulnerability that we'll get to as well. Also here with me is Dr. Sharon Horwood, a senior lecturer in psychology at Deakin University, who researches the link between well-being and technology use. Sharon, listening to Dion explaining his stance on social media and whether it's addictive, where do you stand on this?
Good morning, Tegan. Dan's made some good points there. I think there's certainly an element of reward centres of our brain giving us a little hit of dopamine when we socialise with people and we see people we like online and content we like online. So there's definitely a biological association between socialisation and social media use. I tend to not use the word addiction in my research, though, because it has some pretty significant clinical connotations, and I tend to use the word problematic more so. Mm-hmm. Mainly because it's more, it probably captures a broader range of behaviours. If you say something is problematic, you don't have to be addicted to something for it to be causing you problems. And so problematic use, we kind of define it in a similar way to addiction. We say that it's compulsive use that the person thinks or feels is having some sort of negative impact on their life in some way that they attribute to the behaviour. So it might be impacting their relationship or their work or their study or something like that.
So what kind of harms, can you sort of unpack that a little bit? You're saying it's not addictive. Well, that's not how you'd characterise it, but there's certainly harms occurring.
I definitely think there are elements of addiction in social media, and the main points in social media, or the main things in social media that are addictive, are the persuasive design elements of the platforms. So persuasive design are features that we see all the time. For example, we see them in advertising a lot, and they're often quite obvious in advertising. When you think about any ad that says, you know, hurry, buy now while stocks last, that's sort of meant to give you a sense of limited resources and sort of compel you to think, oh, I need to buy something now before it runs out. So that's a persuasive design technique, and most of us can spot that. But social media platforms have a lot of persuasive design techniques built into them that are harder to spot, harder to recognise that they're having an effect on your behaviour. So, for example, the infinite scroll is a really obvious one. That's where you can no longer get to the bottom of a scroll, say on Instagram, for example. It just keeps going forever. So there's no natural stopping point. There are things like gamification and notifications, even just the format and the colour of platforms are things that are designed to make it really attractive to you and make you want to stay there longer and also come back sooner if you do leave the platform.
So Sharon, there's obviously some really powerful design elements at play, and these are big companies with lots of resources. How much of the problematic use is because of the design of the platforms, which is what was found in this court case in the US, and how much of it is around maybe the culture we've created around social media or our own behaviour?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think we can really ever quantify the first question. I think we can say 50% of it comes from the design features. I think it's fair to say quite a lot of it does, though, because we are we tend to just sort of passively take in content when we're looking at online content. So if we're looking at social media, for example, we tend to take that in quite passively. We just scroll, we absorb, and we don't often spend very much time looking at any one thing in particular. And that can sort of, people feel like they kind of enter a trance-like state, and it gets to that point that Dion was making about the time moving faster than you realise. You suddenly realise it's 30 minutes after you just logged on to have a look at one thing for 2 minutes. So I don't think we can really say how much of it is, but a lot, I think, because persuasive design techniques are demonstrated to be quite powerful in their effect, and people are. Adults find it very hard to resist persuasive design elements. So teenagers and kids who are still developing their self-regulation and self-control, they have not much chance of avoiding those things. Sorry, go on.
I'm really interested to bring in some texts from folks who've been texting in, telling me your experience of social media and whether or not addiction is the right word here. One person says, self-discipline. Why is this no longer a thing? I confess I am struggling with it right now. William says, I used to scroll the Reddit front page endlessly. I found it helpful to restrict my focus to interest-based subreddits instead, and in the worst cases, set a timer. For example, 30 minutes, and when the alarm goes off, the phone gets put down. Another one says, one of the best decisions I've ever made was walking away from all social media platforms 18 months ago. I haven't missed it for a nanosecond. And since eradicating it from my life entirely, my mental clarity and overall brain health have improved enormously. Sharon, how much is personal responsibility a factor here?
It's hard for people to feel like that something like social media can just control them, that we kind of tend to have this belief that we should be able to just stop. And, you know, if somebody can't do that, then that's a failing on their part. But the basic persuasive design elements that I was mentioning, they are so powerful, they're so good at what they do, that I think most people can probably forgive themselves a little bit if they're not able to just have the willpower to stop. I think it's a pervasive enough problem in society. It's certainly anecdotally something that a lot of people struggle with. I think that's evidence in and of itself that social media is not something that's easy to stop using. And once we develop habits, this is a habit like any other habit, once we develop a habit and it becomes very entrenched in our behaviour, it's quite hard to change without a lot of effort. If you think about any other habit, if you're trying to get more exercise or eat more healthily, something like that, those things are often hard to do, and a lot of people fail in doing them when they first try to change a behaviour like that. And sometimes it takes a few goes and some additional supports to achieve a habitual change.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Sharon Horwood from Deakin University. She researches the link between well-being and technology use. And Dr. Dion Tullett-Prado, whose PhD is on the concept of social media addiction, talking about this case in the US where a woman's been awarded millions of dollars in damages for basically the fact that social media sites have been ruled to be addictive. And in her case specifically, preyed or was exacerbated by the fact that she was very young and didn't have a lot of parental control at home. Dion, I'm interested in digging into this idea of particularly vulnerable groups and if we need to be doing more to protect them if these sites are as powerfully addictive or promoting problematic use like we're hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this goes into kind of something that she was just saying before, which is that, yes, you know, there's all these kind of tricks that the social media companies play, but to a certain extent, it's also about the traits of the person. And what do I mean by that? There's this kind of rich get richer hypothesis, which is, I think, very well supported when you're looking at these behavioral addictions, which is that what you find, particularly with tech, with social media, is that the people who get, you know, really addicted or who have the problematic style of engaging with it, as your prior guest would say, they are the ones who were already behind, were already in the red, so to speak, the people who have poor social skills, the people who are struggling to satisfy those needs I talked about before, the need for social applause, for a community, for people around them who love them, for all kinds of things, realistically. You know, different aspects of tech appeal to different needs, whether it's violence, whether it's, you know, sex, whether it's you know, socializing. And people who are failing to meet those needs adequately, who are having a really hard time in life generally, are going to be a lot more vulnerable to social media addiction and the other tech addictions, or problematic styles of use. Whereas what you see with people who are more in the green, you might say, people who are well-adjusted, people who are emotionally regulated, people who have very kind of active and healthy social lives, is that social media can actually enhance that for them. And this is part of what I meant before when I said there's some maybe complications with viewing social media as just solely addictive, is that for some people, you know, using social media can be really positive. You know, it can be a really helpful thing. It can help them build their social network. It can help them keep in contact with people that you wouldn't have the chance to otherwise. It can help you build a career. It can be really kind of a powerful thing for you. And so there's an aspect of vulnerability to it. And this is why I find it hard to blame it just on the social media itself, is we're creating these people right now. You know, for many people, Australia and Western societies in general, you know, these aren't the kind of lucky countries, especially for the youth. And so, you know, just blaming social media alone to a certain degree seems like passing the buck.
So this morning we heard Australia's eSafety Commissioner is investigating social media companies several social media companies for inadequately policing that under 16s ban. Dion, is banning younger kids from social media like we have in Australia the right move?
I would argue that it isn't. As much as I kind of hate social media, if I'm being honest with you, and I'd encourage anyone to use it less if possible, I don't think banning it's realistically the right call. The first thing is, remember, is that rich get richer. Who's going to get off of social media if you ban it? Who are going to be the people who use it less? It's going to be the people who have gotten something from it. You know, when you look at these people who do have a disordered relationship with social media, who have this inordinate fixation on it, who use it too much, who care about it so much, who have a problem, this kind of difficulty controlling their use, they're going to find other ways into it. And this is what I find for my clients when I'm, treating people who you might call social media addicted or something like that. They can get around it. It's actually quite easy to get around those bans. And if you try to shut all the different doors that they could, you know, get through to get around those bans, you're going to inconvenience a lot of people who are using it normally. You're going to stop all the people who would probably get something out of it from going into it. You're going to have to force these companies to get all this biometric data from people and, you know, do all this kind of data harvesting on people and so on, which is horrible for the rest of us. You're really punishing the people who are, maybe you could say, healthy users to try and help the people who are unhealthy users, but they're not going to be helped. And so I think that's more of a kind of a Band-Aid solution, and one that almost says, hey, we're doing something about this, but without actually doing something about it. Mm-hmm. If you're going to try and police these social media networks more effectively, it would probably be about targeting the things the prior guest has talked about. It would be about going after those little tricks that they use, you know, the schedules of notifications, the ways they present information to you, the infinite scroll and so on. You're going after those things, maybe regulating the way that social media presents itself to you, or just trying to actually address, I guess, bigger problems in society that are driving people to social media. Housing market, things like that, you know, these wider issues, which maybe the social media addiction is more of a symptom of than an actual disease in of itself.
Sharon, how would you move the needle on this finally?
I think it's an interesting question. The social media ban in particular has raised a lot of questions from academics about the efficacy of doing something like this, banning a thing. And it has got lots of people who are on either side saying, I think it's a good thing, and others saying it's not so good. I think it's a sledgehammer approach. It doesn't have any nuance, but it's also maybe it's a good first step because we certainly have evidence. There's lots of evidence, my own and others in this area have found consistently found that there are poorer developmental associations for younger kids when they're growing up having more access to particular types of digital technology. And we even see lots of problematic use in adults as well as adolescents. So there is some harm associated with the way that people are using digital technologies. I'm not sure that I agree that it's only vulnerable groups or that people without some vulnerability are more likely to have healthy use. My own research suggests that it's a far more pervasive problem than that. So I think first steps, it's probably not too bad of an idea. I think it clearly hasn't been working as well as we first thought, but I also think we should probably give some credit to the Australian government for maybe taking a bold step in trying to address the problem. It might not be the final solution, but it gives us some data, it gives us some idea of what it might look like to ban something. In the same way that we ban little kids or prevent little kids from having access to other things that we know are not healthy for them. We don't let them drink alcohol or use drugs or drive cars or other things like that. So, you know, perhaps we need to see how it's going to work. It's going to be a long time before we really know because we need a lot of longitudinal data to really know if it has had the effect that people think that it might. And maybe it won't and we'll try a different thing. But I think certainly just not doing anything is probably not the best solution at this point.
Well, Dion, Sharon, thank you both so much for joining me today. Dr. Dion Tullett-Prado is a provisional psychologist whose PhD is on the concept of social media addiction. Dr. Sharon Horwood is a senior lecturer in psychology at Deakin University. She researches the link between well-being and technology use.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.